The way we read is changing. Time we once might have spent curled up with a good book is now often devoted to catching up on blogs and browsing websites. To win readers back, one publisher has a new take on an old-fashioned idea. She's offering a serial novel, just as Charles Dickens used to do. But this one is on the web. She's calling it a wovel. It appears one chapter at a time, and readers have a say in how the plot advances. For member station KUSP, Rick Kleffel reports.
While she was working as an editor at Dark Horse Comics, Victoria Blake used breaks from work to surf the web.
I noticed that I was using my random 10 minutes in between tasks to go to Gawker.com, which is my favorite media gossip site. And I realized that if I provided prose fiction that I would want to read myself online, that I would use those 10 minutes to read prose, not gossip.
Blake left Dark Horse to found Underland Press, an integrated online and traditional print publisher. She wanted to offer exciting, edgy fiction with a touch of the fantastic and to make her website a primary component of her business. She hired Jesse Pollock to help her with web programming and then got together with him, some of his programming friends, a six-pack, and a bag of Oreos. They came up with a genre that demanded a new name, the wovel.
A wovel is a web novel. There's an installment every Monday. At the end of every installment, there's a binary plot branch point with a vote button at the end. Voting is open from Monday to Thursday.
For web programmer Jesse Pollock, the wovel format was reminiscent of the old choose-your-own-adventure books with a high-tech twist.
And that's what was so attractive about the thought of the wovel is allowing the readers to choose their way through and decide on integral changes in the plot.
The results go to the author, who writes from Thursday through Sunday. A new installment is posted on Sunday night and is ready for reading on Monday morning.
Victoria Blake understands this fast-paced format is a challenge for the wovelists. Jamia Jefferson is an author whose books include Wounds, Fiend, A Drop of Scarlet, and Voice of the Blood. She's writing a new wovel, a cyberpunk saga titled First World. As a guide to writing a novel in a serial fashion, she's looking to the past, not the future.
The example of Dickens is a really interesting one. I do have a larger story arc in mind, but it's not as tightly structured as it has been for the print novels that I've written in the past.
Publishing a wovel draws on skills used more often for journalism than fiction. Proofreader Rachel Miller uses tools entirely outside the realm of web work to ensure that the wovel is internally consistent.
I find myself holding up a ruler to the monitor, underlining, you know, going line by line, just, you know, looking at my style sheets or looking back at past stories to make sure that there are, you know, consistencies between characters and plot threads.
I just don't have any time. You know, I get up really early and I have three children, so I'm kind of pressed for time.
Amber Ney reads the wovel at home, late at night, and even sometimes at work.
Sometimes, yeah, if I'm in between projects or doing whatever and I happen to check my email and it would say that the new installment was up, I would click over and read it while I was at work.
By updating the serial format used by Dickens, publisher Victoria Blake is trying to bring an industry born in the 15th century into the 21st century.
It combines the technical functionality of Web 2.0, the creativity of fiction, and the pace of print journalism.
Blake says as reading habits change, the publishing industry has to continually figure out how to keep up. For NPR News, I'm Rick Kleffel.
So is China, as Bernard Baumol put it, heading for catastrophe? For that, we turn now to James Fallows. Over the past 2 years, he's followed China's astounding double-digit growth in a series of quirky essays for the Atlantic Monthly. Those stories are collected in a new book, Postcards from Tomorrow Square. And Mr. Fallows joins us now. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Mr. Roz.
You're in Hong Kong today, and you normally live in Beijing. Are you getting a sense that economic catastrophe is imminent in China?
It certainly is the case that China faces a lot of big pressures. And one way to put this into perspective is that because the U.S. economy is still so much larger than China's, despite China's tremendous growth of recent years, it means that if there is a couple percentage point slowdown in the U.S. economy or consumer demand or demand for exports, that means a much larger proportional effect on the Chinese economy. So certainly everybody in China is aware that there's pressure on the export sector. And I spent actually today in the manufacturing center of Shenzhen, where a lot of these exporting jobs are located. And certainly times have changed from the boom of a year and a half ago. But most people who I'm aware of in China view this as a challenge rather than certain implosion or explosion for what's been going on here.
If there's one person Americans might want to pay attention to, it's a fellow you've profiled. His name is Gao Xiqing. And you've said that he essentially holds America's financial future in the palm of his hand. Who is he?
His life story in brief is now in his mid-50s. When he was a teenager, he was working on a railroad gang during the Cultural Revolution. And then he was part of the cadre of first Chinese students who were allowed to apply for admission to college after the Cultural Revolution. He then eventually went to Duke Law School. He practiced at Richard Nixon's old Wall Street firm. He was a Wall Street lawyer. And then he came back home to Beijing to build their securities industry 20 years ago. And now he's the person who controls the largest part of China's dollar holdings around the world. And so when Americans look at what's happened to stock markets over the last year or so, Mr. Gao looks at what's happened to the $200 billion he has mainly invested in the U.S. And he knows enough about the U.S. to talk as a kind of Chinese Dutch uncle, if you will, about how he thinks the U.S. should shape up if it wants to keep getting this money from China.
So he's essentially in charge of $200 billion in U.S. cash.
He is, and the collective Chinese funds are growing by about $1 billion a day in the amount of dollars they're able to deploy around the world. Mm-hmm. So more and more of the decisions about whether China will buy U.S. Treasury bonds, what kinds of assets it will think are attractive in the U.S. stock markets, and whether it will find dollars worthwhile in general versus euros or yen or anything else, people like Mr. Gao, and Mr. Gao in particular, are making those choices.
Every second of the day, 24 hours a day, the equivalent of you write, two 20-foot-long cargo containers are shipped abroad from China's ports, for example. How are you able to get your head around the sheer size of China and its economy and its changes?
Something which is a predictable shock when you're traveling here is to come across a city that, at least in my case, I had literally never heard of before, and find that it has a population bigger than Los Angeles or bigger than Chicago. This happened to me in a coal mining town whose name is spelled Zibo in Shandong province. I hadn't heard of it, but it has a population of 4 or 5 million people. And so you come across some rise in a road, and you see suddenly more buildings than you might see if you're looking at downtown Dallas.
Wow.
So sometimes I just hold my head and moan because it seems that the world is too big. But it also has been the real joy of being here since the summer of 2006 and just seeing things I had not imagined before I opened my eyes that morning.
In a recent essay you wrote for the Atlantic Monthly, you talk about the Chinese as their own worst enemies.
This is something which is, I believe, a feeling shared among many foreign correspondents in China, and it's very difficult to convey to our readers. And the simplest way I'd put it is that China, to me, seems to be a much better place when you're in it than when you're reading about it on the outside. Mm. When you're reading about it on the outside, all you read about are the latest political repressions, which are true, or the latest factory scandals, or the latest poisonings, or the latest natural disasters, and all those things are true. And when the Chinese government is asked to explain them, it resorts to this Stalin-era agitprop, which makes things look even worse than before. For example, there are Communist Party officials who routinely refer to the Dalai Lama as, quote, a jackal with a human face. And this doesn't really help in sort of worldwide PR. And so there's a good as well as the bad, and I've been trying to explain both how that balance seems up close and also why the Chinese are so ill-equipped to explain it themselves.
James Fallows is the Atlantic Monthly's national correspondent. His collection of essays on China, Postcards from Tomorrow Square, has just been released. Mr. Fallows, thanks for being with us.
Mr. Ross, my great pleasure.
It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
Today, those same words and promises still hold strong. Last year, change was the key word in the presidential campaign, and President-elect Barack Obama is charged with making that change happen. The new year also marks a time for us to make changes in our own lives. So to reflect on the power of words, poet E. Ethelbert Miller joins us to examine the works of past poets and how their words of change and dreams still resonate today. Ethelbert Miller chairs the board of the Institute for Policy Studies and is the director of the African American Resources Center at Howard University. And welcome back.
It's always good to see you.
Happy holidays.
Oh, same to you.
You've written an essay. You're going to share it with us. And you're looking at the work of poet Langston Hughes. First of all, what is it about his work that you most relate to?
I always feel that he's a person who spoke directly to the African-American people and also to America. He also was an international poet. He always has this big smile. You know, he's always jovial. Even when you listen to recordings of his reading, you know, Langston is just a beautiful person. And so I always connected to him. And also his work, which I think is so easy to understand, but so profound at times when you go back and read it a second time.
Would you read the essay?
2008 was a roller coaster ride with its ups and downs. A poor economy, foreclosures, tornadoes, and hurricanes. They bashed our hopes, but hopefully not our dreams. The poet Langston Hughes was our dream keeper. He once wrote, "Bring me all of your dreams, you dreamers. Bring me all of your heart melodies, that I may wrap them in a blue cloud cloth away from the two rough fingers of the world." Our world is changing, and although the world's fingers are still rough, we still seem to be making wonderful progress. One thing which terrorism, wars, ethnic violence, and hatred cannot stop is the strength that resides inside the human heart and our capacity to love. In January, we will once again celebrate Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. We will remember the dream he spoke about back on August 28, 1963. How far have we come? On January 20th, Barack Obama will be sworn in as the 44th President of the United States. It seems as if the time has come to unwrap our dreams, to soften the fingers of this world with songs of peace and hope. When dreams turn into flesh, we discover ourselves. It was Langston Hughes who wrote, "Hold fast to dreams. For if dreams die, life is a broken-winged bird that cannot fly."
Poet E. Ethelbert Miller reading his essay on Langston Hughes. Wonderful verse there. Given that you mentioned the inauguration and it playing such a big part in the metaphor of the poem, he has actually invited poet Elizabeth Alexander to read at the ceremony, and she's only the fourth writer to be asked to read their work as part of a U.S. presidential swearing-in ceremony. If you could choose an African-American female poet from the past that should be thought of at about this time, who would you choose?
Well, I'm very happy that he selected Elizabeth Alexander.
Yes.
And that was one person I was highly, you know, recommending a couple of months ago. But because Obama always seems to be making reference to Abraham Lincoln, you know, one would probably go back and look at what African-American woman was popular during the time Lincoln was alive. And that would lead us to Frances Harper. Her voice really captures the voice of the abolitionist, her voice that witnesses slavery. But when we look at the themes that she addresses in terms of religion, freedom, I think her work would be one that one would invite her to read.
Would you read one of her poems?
This is perhaps one of her favorite well-known poems, "Bury Me in a Free Land." "Make me a grave wherever you will, in a lowly plain on a lofty hill. Make it among earth's humblest graves, but not in a land where men are slaves. I could not rest around my grave. I heard the steps of a trembling slave. His shadow above my silent tomb would make it a place of fearful gloom. I could not rest if I heard the tread of a coffle gang to the shambles led, and the mother's shriek of wild despair rise like a curse on the trembling air. I could not sleep if I saw the lash drinking her blood at each fearful gash, and I saw her babes torn from her breast, like trembling doves torn from their parents' nests. I'd shudder and start if I heard the bay of the bloodhound seething their human prey, and I heard the captive plead in vain as they bound afresh his galling chain. If I saw young girls from their mother's arms bartered and sold for their youthful charms, my eye would flash with a mournful flame, my death-pale cheek grow red with shame. I would sleep, dear friends, where bloated might can rob no man of his dearest right. My rest shall be calm in any grave where none can call his brother a slave. I ask no monument, proud and high, to arrest the gaze of the passers-by. All that my yearning spirit craves is bury me not in a land of slaves.
And that's poet E. Ethelbert Miller reading Francis Harper's poem, Bury Me in a Free Land. Ethelbert Miller chairs the board of the Institute for Policy Studies and is director of the African American Resources Center at Howard University. Thanks so much for coming back.
Oh, thank you.
As longtime listeners know, this program works to help you find books that slip under the radar. Librarian Nancy Pearl gave us a pile of them yesterday, and this morning we have one more. It's from a book from this past year. It's a book from this past year by Elizabeth McCracken called An Exact Replica of a Figment of My Imagination. NPR's Lynn Neary describes it as a beautifully written book about McCracken's first child, who was stillborn. Lynn visited McCracken and her family and has the story.
A fiction writer, Elizabeth McCracken thought she would never write a memoir.
And I probably especially had some scorn for memoirs that were about the worst thing that ever happened to you. Then something really, really bad happened to me, and I realized that I needed to write about it.
As McCracken talks, her two-week-old daughter Matilda sleeps in her arms, and as newborns are wont to do, wakes up every now and then.
Oh, yes. The world. Oh, Matilda. Hard to be a baby. It's very difficult work sometimes.
Matilda is McCracken's third child with her husband, Edward Carey. Their first died inside McCracken's womb in April 2006. McCracken and Carey are very clear on the number of children they've had. If a stranger asks on the street or in a store, they might say, "We have two." But to them, it is unquestionably three. In large part, it was the need to hold on to the reality of their firstborn that led McCracken to write the book. It poured out of her in several weeks after the birth of their son, Gus, a time of conflicting and complex emotions.
I was worried about my grief for the first child somehow interfering with my love for Gus. But I was also really worried about the other, that somehow it was disloyal to my first child to pretend that now everything was all right, that this new and fantastic baby somehow meant that that first death was not as deep a sorrow as it was.
McCracken and Carey, who is also a writer, were living in France during her first pregnancy. They had settled in an old farmhouse near Bordeaux, working on their writing and getting ready for the next stage of their life to begin. But just before the baby was due, it became clear that something had gone wrong. When a sonogram confirmed that the baby was dead, McCracken learned that she would still have to deliver her child, a delivery which was delayed for 36 hours so that doctors could do tests to find out what had caused the death.
The day delay was kind of amazing to me, but the worst thing had already happened. The fact that my child had died was the worst thing. And so I sort of thought, well, you know, if he has to be delivered, he has to be delivered, you know, and it did seem sort of like the last thing that I could do for him.
At one point, McCracken and Carey left the hospital and went to a cafe, McCracken still looking heavily pregnant. Here, McCracken reads from that section of the book.
There was no oxygen in that little plaza in Bordeaux. Edward and I both felt it. I could not look anyone in the eye, lest they smile and ask me about my baby. This was a mistake, said Edward. We don't belong here. Meaning, out in the world. We'd escaped, but where could we go with me in my condition? Time had bent again. Time had developed a serious kink. Our old life, the one where we planned our existence around the son we were expecting, had ended, but our new life, the one where we tried to figure out how to live without him, couldn't start yet.
The baby who died had a name. During the pregnancy, McCracken and Carey had been calling him Pudding. And in the end, Carey says, they made that official.
You know, we had a couple of names that we were possibly going to call him, but he had only ever really been Pudding, and he would have stopped being Pudding, and he would have become something else had he lived, but he didn't, and so it seemed absolutely sensible that that was his name.
Pudding is what you put Pudding on the death certificate.
What his death certificate? What was on his little coffin, and that's who he'll always be.
After a summer spent in England, staying as busy as possible, McCracken and Carrie returned to the U.S., but first, they scattered Pudding's ashes on one of Carrie's favorite beaches on the Norfolk coast.
And that part of the world is sort of stamped now in our heads as a sort of sacred place. And we took Gus there this summer, and seeing him running around on the beach was just fantastic. And I hope... Oh, Mr.
And there he is, on cue. Come here. Come here.
And as Gus bursts into the room with the furious energy of a toddler, his father scoops him up into his arms and comforts him. Once settled down, the two sit on the floor reading books.
That's a dog, and what's that one?
Yeah.
That's right, it's a cat.
And looking at this beautiful boy, so full of life, one wonders, is he the exact replica of the figment of her imagination? Is he their happy ending? No, says McCracken. Gus is not an ending.
He's the start of his own story, and he is unconnected from this thing that happened before him. That's part of my story, but not part of his story. So it's not that I think that Gus is the exact replica, but maybe the book itself is. That I wrote the book trying, as I say, to get every single detail about this person whose face I never looked at while he was alive, and that I couldn't manage to give him a life, but I could write his biography.
But McCracken knows the biography will always be incomplete. The details of her firstborn's personality will always be, as she puts it, entirely imaginary.
I'm holding a 2.5-week-old in my lap who's snuffling and snorting, and I already have a much clearer idea of who she is from knowing her for 2.5 weeks. I think she looks like, when she wakes up, she looks like an old lady who's woken up for no reason in a discotheque. What? What's going on? Why are the lights so bright? What's that infernal racket?
Next summer, McCracken and Carrie will go back to the beach in Norfolk with Gus and his new sister. It seems, says Carrie, like the place where all three of their children are together. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.